party. I'd be doing a lot better if I hadn't found that extra roll of tickets. Yeah. Okay, well, my name is Chris Bond, and I am a senior DB engineer at Etsy.com, which is a... anybody heard of Etsy? Awesome. I think probably half the people in here have worked for Etsy. I'm going to demo Etsy real quick because it plays into this talk, and it'll be helpful for those who haven't seen it to know what it's all about. So, all right, this whole site is powered by Postgres. It has been for 5 years now. Etsy's coming up on its fifth anniversary. And so what Etsy is kind of like, think of it kind of like eBay, but for people who make their own handcrafted stuff. Okay? You can substitute your own word in there for stuff. I do often. So all this stuff is served up here by Postgres, but if I go here and I do a search for gold necklace, let's say. Hope I spelled that right. I can't see this monitor. All these search results are served up by Solr that gets fed by Postgres. So I wanted to show you that because this whole messaging thing plays into this. Okay, agenda for today's talk. We're going to start talking about eventually consistent replications. You probably heard that term a few times during the course of these talks. Then we're going to talk about messaging, what that's all about. We're going to be talking about messaging-oriented middleware, known as MOM. And then some of the messaging protocols and products that are out there. And then what are the considerations if we're going to build something that works with Postgres? What do we have to think about when making... something that's doing eventually consistent replication. Then we'll talk about some usage scenarios, and then I'll talk a little bit about PGMQ. Okay, eventually consistent replication is asynchronous, and the whole deal with it is that the master and slave are not guaranteed to be equivalent until end of time. At any point in time, you've got, if this is our master A, and we're doing eventually consistent replication, and the slave is A prime, then at any point in time, it's going to lag a little bit behind A. And that white part at the top is what's in A, but not in A prime. The other consideration is that this part right here is all good data. It's all consistent. If you were to compare this part here to the same part here, they would be equivalent. But because of this right here, it's not an exact duplicate at any point in time. But that's okay in a lot of circumstances. I want you to think back to what you just saw at Etsy. When I typed in and looked for gold necklace, it came back with thousands and thousands of results. In fact, there's I think there's 4 or 5 million products in there. Under this model of eventually consistent replication, oh, wow. Hold on just a second. I don't think we want to read more of that. Okay. What it really means to an end user is that, let's say that someone is clicking and adding an item right now, and it's a gold necklace, at the same time that I'm searching for a gold necklace. Okay, I might not see it, but I'm going to see 99.99% of everything else. So the question is that acceptable? And I think in a lot of cases, that's totally acceptable. So that then tells us, okay, we can live with eventually consistent replication in that kind of environment. Now, it's not acceptable in situations where you've got like banking. You know, if you imagine some ATMs, you've got three ATMs, and there's $100 in the Marks account, and you got Groucho and Beppo and Chico, and they all go to take out money, right? Well, if those ATMs are being kept up to date with eventually consistent replication, there's going to be a problem. Because Groucho can take out $50, Beppo can take out $50, and then Chico goes to take out $50, but with this eventual consistent thing here, you know, there's going to be a mistake because one ATM is going to say, well, okay, there's still funds in here for Beppo. So for a banking application like that, you want something that's totally synchronous. In other words, if you debit an account or you add any money to an account, it's going to show up on all those nodes at the same time. Okay, so that's a case where this kind of replication doesn't work. Okay, messaging. Now, probably some of you are thinking, I don't care about this messaging stuff. What is it to me? Well, yesterday I attended the talk that Alvaro gave on to ORM or not to ORM. And one of the points he raised is that DBA's jobs are probably threatened a little bit by ORMs because we got less to do, right? We're not writing any logic. And I thought to myself, well, that's not really true because there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we do. I know in my job at Etsy that and we've got an ORM, but the finance people are always coming to me and the marketing people are always coming to me. Hey, can I get some data? Can I do this? Yeah. So there's always stuff for us to do. Now, messaging is important because more and more this enterprise messaging stuff is becoming part of corporate life out there. The odds are that you probably work for a company that's got one of these messaging things in here. And if you don't, you know, you might work for, you know, the latest greatest .com right now, today, but tomorrow you might be working for McDonald's, hopefully in their data department. And they may have a messaging system. In fact, I know they do. So what's really nifty is if we can tie Postgres into this messaging system, then it opens up a whole bunch of cool stuff. So let's talk about messaging. What it is, it's loosely coupled distributed communications. And if you think of network connections, that's really kind of a tightly coupled thing, right? Because if you've got a socket connection or a TCP connection, you know, you put something on the wire and it's going to wind up at its destination. So what this what these messaging things do is sort of buffer that. Okay? So you can input something and it's not going to be delivered immediately. It doesn't have to be. It can stay there forever. Okay, there's two types of messaging. There's topics and queues. Let me explain the difference. A topic is like a broadcast. Imagine it's like a radio station, and you have a portable radio, and you can listen in to that or not. You don't have to. And if you don't listen into it, you're gonna miss that part of the program. You're going to miss that data. A queue is a point-to-point connection. Data is put into that queue, and then at some point at the end, it's consumed by a consumer. So in the parlance of messaging, you've got a producer and a consumer. And so queues have got a couple of characteristics. One is that there's only one consumer. One consumer gets that message, and it always acknowledges that it's received it. One of the cool things about these messaging systems is that you've got guaranteed delivery in these queuing systems, which is really great, because if we're talking about replication, it's good to know that our data is guaranteed to get where it's gonna go, eventually. So when we're talking about doing eventually consistent replication with messaging, we have to use a queuing system because we couldn't just broadcast stuff unless we were guaranteed that all our slave servers were listening all the time and that they had 100% uptime. It wouldn't work if they were just listening to a broadcast. It has to be a queue because if one of them goes down, what's going to happen is the messaging system is going to store that message, that data, and then when the slave comes back up, it can pick up right where it left off. Okay, messaging-oriented middleware was driven by really business requirements of banks and so forth about 15, well, even longer than that, years ago. You know, big companies that were distributed and they needed to make sure that their applications could talk to one another, even across large distances. And so those were some pretty expensive systems. Most of them were custom. Then JMS came along in about the late 90s. JMS is the Java Messaging Service. And a lot of the current MOMs are built on top of JMS. Not all of them, but many of them are. And that's the one that PGMQ is going to focus on. So these MOMs, they have asynchronous messaging instead of a request-response metaphor. Okay? Usually, most systems are, okay, they're going to put out a request and they're going to wait for a response. That doesn't happen with messaging. It sends the message, and as far as it's concerned, once that happens, it's done. Okay, so I just talked about JMS. That's a MOM. ActiveMQ is an Apache project, and it is an implementation of JMS. It features persistent message storing, and it does that by journaling, for fast retrieval, and then also has a second long-term storage, and often a database like Postgres is used for that. So don't be surprised if someday you're told to you know, manage a database that's connected to you know, some type of message queue. The neat thing about ActiveMQ is that it's got a lot of other ancillary products that go with it to make it better than it is. Such as CAML is a routing engine for routing messages all over the place. And it's also got good monitoring tools. It's all written in Java, of course, and so there's a web console. In some of the talks this week, people have asked about replication. Gee, how do I know, you know, how out of sync my database is? Well, with this console in Apache ActiveMQ, you can just look at this console and you're going to see, oh, here are all the messages that are still waiting to be delivered to this end consumer. Okay, here's the architecture. You've got a producer, and it creates the messages. It sends those messages to the ActiveMQ broker, and it tries to send them out to the consumers. If it can't do that, it's going to persist it out to this journal. After a while, it'll persist. The journal will persist that out to a long-term storage database like Postgres. These consumers up here, each one of them is responding to a certain queue. Like I said, there's only one consumer for any particular queue. And so you might be thinking, well, okay, let's say that I want to have two consumers respond to a certain queue. Well, that's where you'll use another product like CAML or whatever to distribute to even more nodes. Protocols. One of the problems with messaging is that the way it grew up was proprietary. You know, proprietary products made for big companies, and no real standards emerged out of that, and there's still no true standard. There are two quasi-standards. One is called STOMP. STOMP is a text format, and it looks a lot like JSON, because that's kind of what it is. It just kind of wraps a JSON object. And it's really nifty because just about every language can generate a STOMP message. And so it's used in, you'll have clients in you know, all the common scripting languages, plus C++ and Java, etc. And one of the nifty things about Postgres is that because STOMP is really a type of JSON thing, I think that, if I understood the lightning talk yesterday, JSON as a data type is going to be one of the projects that's going to be done during the summer of code, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So that'll be really cool, because you'll be able to store JSON objects. You can store them right now as text objects, really. But to have a native data type will be nifty. The other pretty common quasi-standard is AMQP, and it's a binary format. It's an open. It's trying to be an open standard. The problem with it right now is it's in flux. They have not come out with the final version 1.0 yet, and it's every iteration that they do seems to change a little bit. ActiveMQ does not support it, but they say they will support it as soon as a final spec is delivered for it. But there's a lot of momentum, it seems, behind it because with all these systems that have custom formats, a standard of interoperability is needed. And so it seems to be gravitating towards AMQP. OpenWire is another format, and it's by no means a standard because it only works with ActiveMQ, but it is a binary format. It's the default format for ActiveMQ, and it's, as you can imagine, it's faster than Stomp. But as we'll see, Stomp is probably fast enough for what we're trying to do. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about some principles around building something that works with Postgres and messaging. In a lot of the companies I've worked at, which is a lot of startups, the pattern goes like this. They start off on a fairly small machine, and they build something that works really nicely, and their site starts to get traction, and it's getting popular, and all of a sudden, they need more database power. So what do? They go out, and they buy Big Iron. They get a big old honking machine, and that's what we've done at Etsy. That the Etsy server, I think it's half a terabyte with 32 core. It's a pretty big machine, and I can only imagine the power bill on that thing. It's impossible, really, to replicate that kind of machine. It'd be crazy if you're trying to have replicating that machine out. You'd have to buy multiple copies of that kind of machine. Now you might do that to have a hot standby backup. That makes sense. But it doesn't make sense if you're trying to, shard your data out and scale horizontally. It doesn't make sense. So in this scenario, using eventually consistent replication, the master, the Big Iron machine, becomes what I call the database of record. That's the one that's the authoritative database. It's got the final version of all the data. Another consideration is that the replication process should not delay the transaction commit appreciably. Because, first let's talk about what type of data eventually consistent replication needs. We don't need any inter-transaction data. We don't have to worry about that. We only care about data that gets committed. Okay? So, our process shouldn't interrupt a transaction that's going on. It shouldn't delay it. It shouldn't cause it to fail. In case it does fail, though, not the transaction of the master database, but the transaction that's our replication process, the data that we're sending, if that fails, then we should recover it. Because even though we're doing eventually consistent replication, we have to get all the data in order, and it has to all be right. So if something happens where a message doesn't get across to the broker, we have to save that somehow and send it again later. So that's another thing. Another consideration is that this any such system should be really easy to set up. And I'm a big fan of being able to do everything in the database. I want to be able to set stuff up in the database. Final thing for me is it's nice if it's granular down to the user level. If you work in some situations where you've got several different user accounts, some people might want to be able to make use of this. And so it'd be nice to have it work down to the user level and not just be a super user thing that, it's one size fits all. Okay, usage scenarios. This type of system is really not intended for full-on replication. If you want to do that, then I draw your attention to the hot standby feature in 9.0. That's going to be really nifty. And again, if you have those two Big Iron boxes, You wouldn't use this to replicate the data out. You'd use hot standby. Okay, so another consideration of this is, how can I use this? Replication of tables for read-only slaves. Now, at Etsy, we've got, for example, two tables for billing, charges and payments. And once a month, we issue a whole bunch of bills to our users. And what happens is we got a flood of requests for that payment data, for the billing data. And it's really just those two tables. But that's all going and hitting our master database. Sure, it would be nice to put that out on a separate server. So we could use that. We could just replicate those two tables with eventually consistent replication. And as long as we get past the certain billing point where their bill is closed for the month, then we don't care if the data is lagging a little bit. Another use for this would be what I just showed you with Etsy there. If we take our listing data for our products that are on there, well, we might want to not have that all being grabbed off a master. We might want to send it to a system like Solr. Another use is for creating materialized views on slaves. This is what a lot of other replication systems don't do. Most replication systems replicate exactly what you've got on the computer. But often, the data that's really interesting is a combination of data. So it's like a view, okay, on the master database. Well, how do you replicate that over? Let's say that our listing data is not just from one table, it's from several tables, and not every column from all those tables, but just a select view. So it's really a view. It would really be nice to use this to be able to, when certain underlying tables for that view change, to automatically take the data from that view and send it off. And we can do that with this. And playing along with that, I mentioned Solr. It'd be also great if we have to do a data transform for data that's going to wind up in some other system. If you're using Solr or you're using MongoDB, what's really nice about the messaging system from that architecture that I showed you earlier is that this data is going to go from Postgres. It's going to go to the ActiveMQ broker. It's then going to contact the consumer of that. Now, that consumer of that can be a program that's going to take that data and it's going to munge it however it wants and send it off to, let's say, MongoDB. That's really great because you've got your database of record still, which is the master database, and it's feeding out data, which is eventually winding up over in MongoDB, and you know that it's eventually consistent, even though it's been transformed. Another nifty use is sharding. Sharding is where it's a horizontal scaling technique. And what sharding is let's say you've got users, and you've got a million users. You don't want all the requests going on one machine, perhaps. You want to scale that out, and so you want to put different users on different machines. Well, most replication solutions will just replicate the entire user table out to a slave machine. And that's good. That's fine. But another way to do that is to send out messages and know how to route them based on some criteria that you've got in your system. For example, if you want to take the user ID and do a modulus on it, modulus by some number which would split it up into, let's say, 19 or whatever different groups of users, then you can make a separate a queue for each of those, and then you'll have separate consumers for each of those which represent slave machines. Okay, so now we'll talk about this PGMQ thing. It's an add-on shared library. It's open source. Currently working out the license of it. We want it to be BSD, but there might be some stuff that's like MIT, and I'm not sure about how all that stuff works, so we're looking at that. It's event-driven by CRUD, which is create, update, and delete for the payload. I'll explain the word payload. Payload in the parlance of messaging is the message body. Okay. It's analogous to email, the message body, because there's a header and then there's the payload. The way it works is constraint triggers are used to call these PGMQ functions. Does everybody here know what a constraint trigger is? It's kind of buried in the Postgres documentation.
Wait, it's nice to know somebody else is abusing constraint triggers.
Yeah. Am I abusing them? Is this an abuse?
You're not really supposed to use them to execute external code.
Right, I must have missed that warning. I don't think it's in there. The truth is, a constraint trigger is really just like any other trigger, according to the documentation, except it's deferrable. Now, I don't know why it's not called a deferred trigger. It might be better to think of it that way. But what it's really used for is for doing constraint checks at the end of a transaction. If you go look in the source code, and I think it's in the exact.c file, there's a loop in there that's doing transaction loop. And one of the very last things that happens before the real commit happens is that all deferred triggers are called. Now, any other regular trigger is called much earlier. And the reason why constraint triggers are of use here, and frankly, the system would work without them, but it's kind of nice to use them, and I'll tell you why. Because we don't want to overload the transaction with any extra work, okay? And we're stingy, so we're going to try to get all we can out of this. If there's a failure and there's a rollback, that's going to happen way before this constraint trigger is ever called. So we don't do any work.
Except the user sets all constraint immediately.
Well, they're not going to do that because we're going to check for that. It's true. With these deferred triggers, when you create a constraint trigger, you can set its whether it's deferrable and whether it's deferrable immediately or executed immediately. I forget the code words for it. But the gentleman there is right that there's also a set constraint command that you can change that at any one time so you can immediately execute any constraint triggers. I don't think that would really cause a problem with this because if you did call the constraint trigger, they're still going to fire within the transaction. They're just going to fire earlier. And I've got confidence in my triggers. So they're not going to cause a problem. I just like having them fire at the end of the process, the end of the transaction, because that's just the natural place for it to happen. So those triggers call functions, then they're asynchronous, so that they go off and do their own thing and the transaction can continue. If you look at that C file, there's a immediately after the transaction closes or commits, there's a callback. And that gives you control. Your program can receive this notice from Postgres, hey, I just did a commit. Okay? So what those triggers really do is they set up the data that's going to be replicated. Once that data is set up, then PGMQ waits to hear that callback. When it gets the callback, then it says, okay, I can go ahead and I can ship this data out now because I know it's real. Before the commit, the data is not real. It's just a maybe. But once that commit happens, it's real. Okay. PGMQ can convey rows in their entirety, subset of a row, or a view, as we already discussed. There's a persistent store of unsent payloads. So what happens is, let's say that we have an update to table, an insert to table A. Our constraint trigger will eventually pick that up, and it's going to call some functions that actually convert that into a JSON object. That JSON object is going to be stored in a text field in a table. And that's nice because we have a client that's now talking to ActiveMQ, and if that fails, we want to make sure we still have that data because we're going to have to resend it. So that's why we have to store it like that. Oh, and then there's another little, there's some little auxiliary programs that come with this thing, and one of them is a program to kickstart replication. This is an interesting issue. If you've ever tried to, let's say you have a live database and you want to replicate table A out to a slave machine, it's actually a hard thing to do, because even if you use copy or you do a PG dump and a backup, as soon as the dump is done, it's old news, because new stuff has come along since. So how do you get around that? Turns out that there's some nice little asynchronous calls there in that libpq stuff. And what you can do with that is, and what this program does, is it will do a copy command out to your slave, and at the very same instant, it's going to start recording messages, sending messages out to ActiveMQ. When the copy is done, this thing switches on the receiver there to say, hey, you can start reading messages now. Okay? Because if we have a database A and we want to replicate it out, over time, to get them equivalent, you're going to take a snapshot of A plus any differences since that snapshot equals consistency. So if we can copy the data over and at the same time keep storing messages, then we can replay those messages after the copy's done, and eventually it's going to catch up. Now, I'll show you a diagram of that in just a little bit. Okay, so here's the architecture of PGMQ. You'll notice that right here, it's taken the place of the producer. This is a very similar diagram to what I showed you earlier, except that PGMQ is now here. It's sitting on the big iron, and it's tightly bound there with Postgres, and it's sending messages out to ActiveMQ Broker. And ActiveMQ Broker is then sending out those messages to the consumers. Now, these things could be different things. A could be, a slave server that's replicating some single table. B could be one that's another Postgres server that's materializing a view. C could be MongoDB. And remember, now these things are consumers. If we're just going to Postgres, you're going to be using a client that knows how to read those messages and put them into Postgres. Same thing for B. For C, if we're doing a transform and going to MongoDB, then that little program right there would take that data that's coming from ActiveMQ, and it's going to do a transform on it, and then it knows how to talk to Mongo. Okay, so here's this program I was talking about. I call it SwiftKick. And the way it works is, again, when you replicate the data, again, like table A, it's going to do that copy. At the same time, it's sending messages. As soon as this thing is done, then these messages start going into the slave, and it'll start catching up. So if we had to replicate, like, listing data over to a new server, we could use this, and as soon as this copy is done, we can make a decision. Gee, do we put it live now, or should we wait? Well, we'd probably look at our little web console and see how far behind it was. We might say, well, it's only 2% behind. I'm going to talk a little bit about performance of this system. Etsy has, like I said, between 4 and 5 million active listings. And these folks are really active. They're updating this stuff all the time, adding new listings, etc. 30 per second. That's how many updated CRUD operations happen on the actual data. Out of a data set of 4 to 5 million, it's about 30. Same with our billing tables. It's about 30 per second. This system with Stomp can run pretty reliably at about 1,500 per second. So you can see it's way, way powerful, and more than this is needed. Now, you might have some systems where, boy, you just got a ton of data and there's just a ton of writes and updates that maybe exceed 1,500. Then this isn't the system for you, but maybe ActiveMQ will catch up. What happens if it does fall behind is is that stuff that's not consumed just gets put into this journal. This journal is a very, very fast thing, and then Postgres is there as a long-term storage of that those messages if they can't be delivered. Once they're delivered, they get deleted from the journal, and you can decide whether you want to keep them forever or if you want that delete to also go out to Postgres there. Okay, future enhancements. This thing is available at pgmq.org, but not right now. If you go there, there's nothing there. But there will be in about a week. I'm heading back on Sunday, and I have a couple things to do, and then I'll get this stuff out there. One of the things we want to do is support for more MOMs. Okay, because right now we support ActiveMQ. There's a lot of other systems out there. There's QPID, and there's Active. There's RabbitMQ. Bunch of other ones, and it's actually really, really pretty easy to support these because all these things just run and they listen on a port, and all you're doing is sending data to this port. That's really all it is. So it's really easy to create stuff. It's really about the format. The stomp format is really convenient for this. It's fast enough for most needs, but if you that AMQP stuff comes along, probably want to support that. And that's a binary format, and so that's a different ballgame. I also want to do some enhancements to that SwiftKick product, because I showed you working with going to a database, but I thought, well, why not try it with like a log file of some sort? You could write out select statements insert statements, delete statements, update statements to a log, and then meanwhile, send messages, and then when the current data set is out there in this log file, then you can put stuff out to it. And so you have then a running log, and you could take that and bring a database up pretty quick with that. Another interesting thing is that I've been thinking about is maybe taking the wall logs and publishing them out this way. I don't know what would happen with that. Might be a dumb idea, but it might be interesting to play with that. So, that's it. Short and sweet. Questions, please.
What's the unit of distribution? Is it a single tuple, or is it a transaction full of tuple?
No, it's a single. Every JSON object represents a tuple. Okay? Like I said, that can be either the, because this is trigger-based, it can be the row that's being updated, it can be a portion of that, or it can be a completely different set of data.
Is there any way to bookmark the begin and end of a transaction so your consumer can know to apply all of them?
No. It just sends the data out like that, and it just gets applied. Yeah, there's no concept in this thing of, two-phase commit. Again, this is mostly for read-only results, right? For read-only stuff. I wouldn't use this for any type of replication where that kind of thing would come into play.
Well, I wasn't looking for like a two-phase commit or a guaranteed replication to slave. And the read-only part is fine, and the credential part is fine. What we're looking for is to use something similar to this for an application.
That wouldn't be that hard to do, because I told you about that callback that happens when a transaction ends. Well, the system has knowledge of everything really that's happened up to that point, because we're going off a trigger. We're only concerned really about, that's the focus of this thing, is concerned on that data. I mean, that's the hook. There's something about that table that's of interest to us. But if you wanted to do what you are discussing, then you could put a trigger on that the table of interest, and then that'll give you knowledge probably of that. You can then have a hook onto the transaction, and you can probably figure out everything that's happened there. Might get a little hairy, but...
Since you're putting a constraint trigger on a table, do you ever have a use case where you need to send a message down to your consumers which isn't a data change, like, I don't know, some random message you need to send out to all the consumers that's not triggered by, I put a, you know, a new handbag on Etsy?
I haven't really come across that type of case. You can control, you can, you know, switch the consumers on and off, that kind of thing.
So when you, in other words, in your constraint trigger, you kind of have the thing that transforms the message right there based on the state of the data in the table, is that right? Like you're basically changing into a kind of a quasi-JSON object and pushing it out through stomp.
Right.
Trigger.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah,
and it's your job to set up the data. You know, if you're going to send this stuff out to a database, you have to go out and set up the database and set up the tables. I mean, this thing could probably do it, but it's easy enough to do that.
And you haven't had any problems with AMQ because we tried it and we ended up finding it falling down and we had problems with the messaging, the mailing list, and frankly, we ended up going to WebSphere.
I haven't had a problem, but we haven't loaded this thing. This thing is pre-production. It's not in production. The whole impetus for this came about because of the problems with updating the solar stuff.
What's solar?
Solar is sort of a inverted search engine. It's really, really fast.
Okay.
We were having before that we were doing search with T-Search,
right.
And it just wasn't working out because of all the like and clauses that people say. I want this and this, but not this.
Right.
And that works really much better in solar. The problem with solar is how do you get the data to it?
Right.
And so the way it had been working is there's a little program that every 3 or 4 minutes, I think it goes out and it says, what's new?
Right.
And then it gets that, and it would get all that data. But that's not a good way to do that. It's much better to make that kind of thing event-driven in the database. And so that's what this will do. And with solar is an example of where we actually take a view. It's a view of the data. And so that thing would go and select from a view.
Does it select from a view on a database that's being fed by your messaging queue then, as opposed to the big iron? I mean, is that how you're sharding it to get it to solar?
No. We put the data in this JSON-type object. We ship it out as stomp, and those guys built a Java consumer that knows what to do with that.
So it's holding in memory and solar.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Right. Another problem with solar, just as an aside, is that you have to rebuild the index every once in a while, and it's a pain point. Anybody else?
Did I understand correctly that the whole thing is built on pushing the messages? Or is there a way to put it in a pulling mode?
No, it just pushes the message. What do you mean by pooling mode?
Like the consumer would go out and pool the stuff that it wants to, not the other way around.
Yeah, the consumer there is, depends what you mean by the consumer. Okay, if you're talking about the database isn't strictly the consumer. The consumer is actually the little client program that's going to feed. Right. You could take that and put that into a pooler. You could do that.
I wanted to pull the stuff when it's ready, not that the master would go around all the time and try to push and go insane when it's done. So.
I guess the question is, who is the one that initiates the request for the data? If the server pushes?
Oh, the server pushes. The server is responding. This is an event-driven system, okay?
Yes, sir.
The event is a CRUD operation. Okay, CRUD operation happens, and the whole idea behind PGMQ is that it's just going to take that data and send it out to ActiveMQ, and then it's done. So we want that to be very lightweight. After it goes away, we don't care about it. ActiveMQ is handling it. Okay, that's why we like these messaging systems, because they handle persistence, they're high performance, they've got real smart people working on them. Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let it take care of it. You know, if you look at, like I said, 30 updates per second for listings, another 30 for billing stuff, we're not talking about a lot of data right there. So bottom line is, if you are in a company and all of a sudden someone says, hey, you know, really like to get some data, think of, if you've got some queuing system going up, as we say at Etsy, throw a queue in front of it. Fire away, my friend.
Okay. The first one is, what would happen if the connection from the database, the Big Iron, to the broker is lost?
Right. Well, what happens...
The system will be paid.
Well, what happens is, I told you that the JSON object gets stored on the master.
On the Big Iron?
Or it's stored on the Big Iron.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kept there.
Okay.
And there's a notation is made about whether it was successfully sent out. Okay.
I thought it was stored in the broker.
No, no.
Okay.
No.
How do you do that notation? You get an ACK back from the ActiveMQ that says I got it?
Yeah, the client is going to... There's a client that's talking to ActiveMQ, and it knows when the payload has been delivered successfully.
So then it writes back to the same log table?
It's going to go back and say, yeah, this one's done.
Okay.
Yeah. That might be burdensome if it gets to be a really huge data set,
yeah.
But not so far. This is just another thing that you might want to keep in your DBA kit bag as a tool to provide a solution, because if you live in one of these environments where there's ORMs, these ORM guys think it's fantastic, but you know it's all oriented towards the front end. Okay? There's a lot of back end stuff that happens. And if you were to go and say, gee, you know, the Joe down in finance wants this stuff, they'd say, why come to me with your problems? You know? So this is a way for you to get data out there really easily. And I think that the cool thing for me is the SwiftKick thing, because I've had so many times when I wanted to replicate data, and you can never get it in sync.
Yeah.
It's a real pain. Try materializing a view on a database that's quite active and try to get it in sync with exactly what the view would deliver.
Right.
Almost impossible. This makes it actually pretty easy. Yeah. I mean, you could just sit back, fire that thing off, kick back, take a dip, and by the time you're done, it's done. You're ready to go.
So, out of curiosity, when you plan to change it so that it maybe can speak 8K or QP or other things,
yeah.
How deep down into your functions do you have to go to like change the protocol coming out of the database?
I don't know. It's just another transform. You know, really, we're taking this the tuple, right?
Right.
And we're affecting a transform that turns into a JSON object. I'm sure there's some other, there's going to be some spec for the AMQP stuff. And either me or someone else will figure it out. I'll also say this, that there's a lot of other replication systems out there that I wouldn't be surprised to see this functionality added to. For example, Bucardo could very easily do this kind of thing. It works in a very similar way. It's trigger-based also. Another trigger-based system is Sloney. They might, they might tack something on like this as an extra thing to do.
No, I mean, the value that you're giving here is, as opposed to PGQ or Bucardo,
yeah.
Sloney at the moment is that you're going out to an outside of the database messaging protocol,
right.
Which allows us to feed it into other applications that don't require Postgresing. That's clear, and that is
right.
Kind of your value add on this.
That's the value add,
yeah.
Right. The other thing I would say is just that most replication systems, again, are replicating the entire database. It's really nice to be able to just put out part of the database. A lot of times we have to do that.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah,
go ahead. Oh, sorry. Josh was first.
Oh, so with, I'm just using Stomp now.
Yeah.
How reliable is the guaranteed delivery?
It's very reliable.
Okay.
You mean through ActiveMQ?
Yeah.
Oh, that's rock solid.
Okay.
I mean, that's used. ActiveMQ is used in some big enterprises, and it's rock solid. That whole JMS, the Java messaging system, is really rock solid. I mean, if there's one thing, I'm not a real Java fan because, sorry, buddy, I just don't like coding in it. All those files. Yeah, so, but the fact is that most of those enterprise systems for finance and stuff are probably written in Java by now. Almost all of them are.
notify that are coming in Postgres 9, where you can send a message to a channel with a different payload.
Right.
Would that help your use case at all?
Yeah, that's nice, because as I understand it, listen, notify, you can now get a message.
You can get a payload, yeah.
Yeah,
message.
Right. And so that can tell you various things.
Right.
Haven't really digested that yet, but I think it's kind of interesting. Oh, the other interesting thing, let me point this out, that's coming along in 9.0 is the enhancements made to triggers with the when clause. I think it is when. Is that right, Robert? Isn't it when?
Yes.
Yeah. That's where you can say, okay, here's my trigger, fire it when.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, let's say you've got a... let's say you've got a tuple from this listings table, and you say, you know, I don't want to fire this thing off if just the some minor characteristic has changed. Okay, then you can check, you know, when you know there's a you can check, and that's really going to be nice.
Right. I mean, because arguably, what you could think about with 9.0 is you have a when on your trigger. You put a notify in there, then you have some lightweight middleware client that's listening to all the notifies with a connection that does the transforms and sends it to the broker.
Right. I mean, that's basically, actually, that's not far off from what this thing does. Okay, really. And actually, if you look at systems like Bucardo, I believe that they have a, you know, there's another little client server out there that's just sitting and it's listening. And also, one of the nice things, if you work with Python, I don't know if you heard this, but within the past couple weeks, Federico got PsychoPG2 to dial into those asynchronous function calls in libpq that I was talking about.
Yeah, it was in the Lightning talk yesterday.
Yeah, it was in the Lightning talk also. And that's really great because you can dispatch things. Like that whole SwiftKick program could be completely rewritten in Python with that capability because it needs that ability to do two things at the same time like that.
So, yeah, what I was meant to say is that as long as it's the big iron who transforms data into the JSON object, I always think about, I mean, it's a very interesting feature that you can select what subset of information you want to replicate or even just to transform it. So as if you were using materialized views.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm thinking just could be quite expensive to transform the data if you're going to perform a very complicated materialized view. So maybe it would be an interesting improvement, future improvement. I was just thinking about if you use wall shipping to a different server and then perform the triggers on that server. So you can offload the capacity of transforming data, generating JSON, and sending to the broker.
Since we're
different servers.
Absolutely. Since we're talking about eventually consistent replication, now even with the streaming standby, that server is always going to be not absolutely 100%, but it doesn't matter because we've accepted ECR as something we can live with. And so, yeah, you could put it there and offload the thing. Yeah, it's not really a lot of work to generate those JSON objects. It's really pretty easy. I mean, even if you have, like in Python, you've got a dictionary, right? If you get a string representation of that dictionary, it's almost a perfect JSON type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think comment on that, you're not allowed to modify a replica in the, you're not allowed to have data modifications taking place on a replica.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right.
So you can't have any different behavior.
Very true. Yeah.
Streaming replication is identical. The database is
absolutely
the identical stuff. So
thanks for pointing that out. That's totally true.
That's wishful in a very deep way.
Yeah. It'd be hard to just make the triggers themselves, check to see where they're running before they decide to do anything. And there's a way for the code to detect if it's on a replica or if it's on a non-replication to decide whether or not to just return without doing anything or actually instead.
You know, when I first started thinking about all this, I first took a look at the wall file and said, well, gee, maybe I can separate out, like, for a certain table, I can get just that stuff. That's a total nightmare. But it would be nice. I think that there's probably, I'm going to conjecture out here that there's going to be probably some work done on the wall file format at some time, some point, because I hear it's kind of hairy. And it would be nice if you could get that kind of information out of it easily. Wishful thinking.
You can't know what you're talking about, about all these, because you can actually put custom, so you can move all the data with that, with custom triggers that redraw your materialized views on the replica.
Yeah, if people were doing slumming.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of really good replication solutions out there, and they're all a little bit different, and all of them have their special place. Like I said, this is something you might want to put in your kit bag, because you never know in the enterprise when someone might say, hey, can you do this? Yeah, I could do that.
Yeah, the ability to move subsets of like data.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, the subset thing. I mean, this is what I call, you know, practical DBAing, you know. Anybody else? I thank you all very much for your time.
Was it just recorded or was it video?
Wait, it's actually just recorded off
the output,
yeah.
And with the voice.
With the voice, yeah. Okay. Yeah, because you don't really need videos of the people talking, you just need to hear their voice and see the slides.
Right.
So it's also good for demos.